Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to talk about something that is out of this world. We talk about enemies, well, foreign and domestic, but there's also an enemy at hand that may well be the most devastating of all, and that would be Mother Nature. We are, as we speak, about to be subjected to something that happens periodically, fortunately not very often, and fortunately not in the worst way imaginable, but it's a distinct possibility at any moment. And that is a geomagnetic disturbance, a fancy term for a solar storm. And for reasons that we at the Center for Security Policy and with a host of colleagues we have pulled together over the years under the banner of the Secure the Grid Coalition, we've all been warning about. Our electric grid is extremely vulnerable to the kind of intense electromagnetic energy that the sun lights off periodically in these solar flares. A man who has studied this closely and been tirelessly working for now the better part of a decade to do something about it is my friend and my colleague at the Center for Security Policy. In fact, he's our president and CEO these days, having fleeted up, as they say, to that position from his role leading our Secure the Grid Coalition. His name is Lieutenant Colonel Tommy Waller. He is a retired United States Marine Corps Force Reconnaissance combat veteran and a very distinguished warrior, both in uniform and since he's taken it off, for freedom and for the security of the American people. I'm delighted to have him with us always. Tommy Waller, I cannot thank you enough for the service you have rendered to our country, and I know you're fond of saying that it pales into insignificance by comparison to what those who are trying to keep our grid going do day in and day out. I think you're too modest, but I do appreciate the point you're making that our very existence as a nation is dependent upon the functioning of that grid. And I want you to talk a little bit about what's headed our way as we speak. By the time the show airs, hopefully it will have passed without terrible impacts, but it could, and if not this time, in the near future. Talk to us about both the larger problem of GMD, as it's called, and the vulnerabilities of our grid and what might befall us at any time.
Sure. Yeah, Frank. So right now, actually, as of last night, our national, it's like the National Weather Service for space, basically, right? So the Space Weather Prediction Center in Boulder, Colorado, upgraded for the first time in 19 years the warning that they have about this particular solar storm to the level of severe. And specifically what they said is that people may actually witness aurora borealis as far south as Alabama. Now, when we say aurora borealis, we mean like the northern lights, right? That's something you normally just see in the very uppermost northern hemispheres. And so for Americans to be prepared to witness that further south, they might be excited about it. They might be kind of excited. Like a month ago yesterday, 150 million Americans stared up into the sky with special glasses to look at a solar eclipse. And that very same day, I was testifying again to the U.S. Secretary of Energy, Jennifer Granholm, on this risk of solar weather and what it can do. It can devastate our grid. If we witness aurora borealis that far south, there is a very good chance that the crust of the earth upon which we stand will be witnessing something else. And that's called ground-induced currents. Those ground-induced currents can absolutely wreck really, really important parts of our electric grid, and I'd be happy to explain exactly how that works.
Yeah, I want to get into it, Tommy, because we take the functioning of the electric grid as much for granted as we do that when we breathe, we'll have oxygen and all will be well. There have been warnings, and our friends, Dr. William Graham and the extraordinary men and women who served on the electromagnetic pulse Commission have been telling us that something like this is inevitable. It's just a matter of time, and it may be considerably worse, please God, than what is going down right now. And yet, despite those warnings over what's been now, Tommy, 15 years or so at least, has much been done to remedy this situation? What has the Secretary of Energy been saying to you when you point out these vulnerabilities, for example?
To her credit, she's very pleasant. She's nice. She invites comments from the public for every one of her Secretary of Energy Advisory Board meetings. But the government's done almost nothing. And the last meeting we had, she actually said, hey, I want to know more about this ground-induced current thing. And she turned to one of the people in that room who was a very, very senior executive associated with a research institute for the electric utility industry. He said, ma'am, that's something we have it all under control. And that's not the truth. Those ground-induced currents, Frank, that I just mentioned, right? So Earth's magnetosphere, when it heaves and moves and wobbles from that massive solar storm hitting it, it generates those currents. They travel through the crust of the Earth. They're looking for the path of least resistance. And that's what our long transmission lines are in the grid. And so we have the prospect of those currents entering our grid through something that we cannot operate the grid without, and that's these extra high voltage transformers. And those transformers can actually be devastated by this ground-induced current. I showed pictures to the Secretary of Energy of just one transformer in Salem, New Jersey in 1989 from the Hydro-Quebec solar storm. And that thing needed to be completely replaced. And that's exactly what could happen. It could happen tonight, depending on the size of the solar storm.
Wow. And if we have to replace a grid, is that the kind of thing you just go down to Walmart and order up one and have it online in a matter of days?
You know, unfortunately, I mean, back when these studies started, when you mentioned the Congressional EMP Commission back then, you know, the lead times for transform production were about 18 months. For many of these now, Frank, it's 4 to 6 years. So you lose a transformer like that, that part of the grid's not coming back for a very, very long time. And so, you know, but here's the thing. It's a fixable problem. And this is what we explained to the secretary. There's technology out there that's actually been proven and tested that's operating all the time in at least three parts of the grid. A neutral ground blocker is what it's called. It all it really does is block that current, right? So if you can imagine, you've got this current traveling under your feet and it wants to find the path of least resistance. It sees these long transmission lines and it pops right up through the ground through one wire, the grounding wire on a transformer. All it does is clamp to that wire and block that current. It's that simple. And these things have been tested. They're affordable. Frank, the price tag to fix this problem for the whole country is just over $4 billion. Which is 1/3 of 1% of the Biden infrastructure bill, yet they refuse to spend that money at the federal level.
Tommy, this is such an important point, and I just can't tell you how aggravating it is to me, and I'm not nearly as close to it as you are in our Secure the Grid Coalition. And I want to encourage people. This is just an example of what we do at the Center for Security Policy, folks, which is put together, well, tiger teams like your old outfit in the Marine Corps, Tommy, to go get things done. And this one has been working tirelessly, as I say, for, well, 15 or so years at least. And Tommy, the thing about it is that, as you say, in so many cases, there are practical, affordable things that we can do. The Center for Security Policy, the Secure the Grid Coalition has been urging them. We actually have an immense amount of money that has been appropriated by the Congress to do this sort of thing, to improve our infrastructure. And it is insane that it's not been spent immediately to solve this problem. Tommy, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to pick up on the other side about that and what's happening, for example, in Texas to try to fix these problems. Stay tuned, folks. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Biden administration's outrageous efforts to surrender our nation's sovereignty and personal medical freedoms to a Chinese Communist Party asset running the World Health Organization turns out to have another problem. It would also supplant U.S. states' rights to make decisions on public health, a power the federal government is not assigned under the Constitution and therefore is not entitled to give away to Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus or anybody else. This position was powerfully declared yesterday by 22 states' attorney general in the second formal throwdown with President Biden over the WHO in as many weeks. Like every Republican member of the Senate, these states' senior legal officers reject the accord still being stealthily negotiated less than 3 weeks before they are supposed to be approved. That approval must not happen. Join these American patriots in saying so at sovereigntycoalition.org. This is Frank Affney.
We're back. Tommy Waller is in the House, Lieutenant Colonel, United States Marine Corps, retired, the president and CEO of our Center for Security Policy. And I just wanted to say again, folks, the kind of leadership that Tommy has brought to this issue of grid security and infrastructure security more generally is, I think, just about unparalleled. And the partnering up that we're able to do with great, great folks like members of our Secure the Grid Coalition is something that I think, well, if you haven't already joined us in supporting this work, when you see what's going down today, you may very well want to make it possible for us to be even more effective. And Tommy, we were talking a bit about the federal government's lack of response to the sorts of vulnerabilities. And by the way, it's of course not confined to threats from Mother Nature. There's a lot of reason to believe that, well, every enemy of this country understands the vulnerabilities of our grid and how they can be exploited to devastating effect against this country. Why is it the federal government is not doing more on this? Is it that they don't have the money? I just suggested the other is the case, but what's afoot?
Frank, so with respect to the U.S. federal government in the present moment right now, with the Biden administration, Secretary Granholm, at the helm of the money that has been allocated from Congress, any reason why they would not spend it on things like protecting against solar weather is ideological, right? What we see is we see massive expenditures on other things that, for whatever reason, philosophically, they believe are wise investments, most of which are in what they call the, quote, renewable space, wind and solar, and other areas like that that just won't provide the power we actually need for the grid that we need to live. So these are ideological decisions being made by them that are not necessarily based on facts and just data, right? When I presented this information to the secretary, I showed her irrefutable, scientifically based empirical data that demonstrated the risk of the solar weather that is out there and the terribly low standard that the U.S. federal government approved for the protection of the grid against solar weather. In fact, the standard that they approved makes it so the utility industry has to do absolutely nothing to defend against solar weather. And that was the point. When the utility industry developed the standard and the federal government through FERC approved the standard. So what can we do about it?
FERC is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Right,
exactly. And what you see is full-on regulatory capture at the federal level. And so what we're doing at the moment, Frank, is we are pushing this as hard as we can at the state level. We're still sounding the alarm for the federal government where we can, but we're pushing at the state level. What I want to emphasize, too, is we're not doing this to try to get grant money. I mean, our Center for Security Policy doesn't take a dime from the government at any level. We don't take money from the utility industry. We don't take money from the companies that produce these technologies that can protect the grid. We're doing this for the public interest. And unfortunately, right now, what you see is a severe lack of action and effort on the part of the federal government for that public interest. But thankfully, thank God, there are people at the state level who actually still care about their people. And that's exactly who we're meeting with.
Well, I want to get into that in a moment. Let me just say, if you would like to support the work that is not being compromised by, you know, funding from those sorts of sources that Tommy's just mentioned, please visit centerforsecuritypolicy.org. Go to the donate page. You will help make the work Tommy's talking about here and a whole lot of other important things happen as a result. Tommy, so you're in the state of Texas in particular. There's a big utility sort of operation there called ERCOT. You've been trying to work with them to get some of this hardening, as it's called, of the grid in Texas undertaken. You've been working with a wonderful state legislator there by the name of Senator Bob Hall. Tell us where that stands as an example of what, well, can and must be done across the country.
Sure. Well, I think everybody probably remembers Winter Storm Uri, where Texas, the entire ERCOT grid went dark for 3 days and more than 240 Texan citizens died and hundreds of billions of dollars of economic loss. That got the attention of the state. And what ended up happening was the state established a standard for weather protection, cold weather protection, that was more effective and established faster than anything the federal government had ever done. And they implemented it and it worked. And what we're trying to do right now is have them apply that same can-do attitude to these other threats. And so just yesterday, I had the opportunity to sit down with the Public Utility Commission chairman to brief them thoroughly on this threat of solar weather, to break it all down on why this is such an important thing for the state to take action on because of the failure of the federal government. And they were very, very accommodating and interested. And so what we have right now, Frank, is a campaign.
Let me just say, this was not arranged with knowledge of this storm coming down, was it? This is something that you've been working on and trying to help in Texas for years now.
That's right. Yeah, the solar weather threat happens every day, all the time. In fact, I mean, these neutral ground blockers that are currently installed in the grid in three different locations, they constantly trip off with just small solar weather, the effects of the ground-induced currents, the kinds of weather that's not going to crush the grid permanently, but still damages equipment. And so, you know, as I explained to them yesterday, this stuff is happening all the time. We don't know when a large storm's coming. Then I get on the airplane and I get a text message with a Fox News story saying, well, there's a pretty decently sized storm coming tonight. I had no idea, right? So that's something that should get their attention. Hey, we just got a brief on this major risk, and here's a news peg saying it's about to happen. So the good news is, Frank, that we actually have a campaign people can get involved in at our website, centerforsecuritypolicy.org. Click on the infrastructure security tab, and then just look right at the top where it says take action, prevent a federal takeover of the Texas grid. Uncle Sam wants to take over the Texas grid. This administration, the Biden administration, wants that energy, and they want control of the Lone Star State. And we can't let that happen, because they've failed in every aspect of grid security. And so American citizens can actually take action to petition our government to keep Texas independent and actually begin securing the ERCOT grid against all the threats Uncle Sam's failed to address.
You know, this is just a little level setting, Tommy. There are actually three elements to the grid. There's an Eastern interconnect, as they call it, that goes basically from the East Coast to the Rocky Mountains, and then the Western Interconnect from the West Coast into the Rocky Mountains. And then Texas is largely covered by its own grid. What are the people that you're talking to in Texas saying about the idea of having that expropriated, I guess is the word for it, by the feds?
Frank, the only people who I know in Texas that want that are the people who are, again, extremely ideologically aligned with the Biden administration. Every single person I've spoken to in Texas is against that idea. The people that are for it are, you know, the Congressman Kaser that sponsored the Connect the Grid Act. When you look in his background, this is a man who is deeply ideologically aligned with Marxists and socialists, right? I mean, he's literally came from the Socialist Party. And I think all know—
This is a member of Congress from Texas?
Member of Congress. That's right. Who sponsored the you know, and at his press conference, you know, AOC is there in support of this idea. I mean, you take your laundry list of people in elected office who are ideologically aligned with socialism, and that's who you've got supporting these issues. Thankfully, most of the people in Texas are not in support of that. And we all have an opportunity to actually have our voices heard with the Align Act campaign that we have on our website to keep Texas independent.
Yeah. Well, again, this is another example of the work we do at the Center for Security Policy, and I'm so proud of it, Tommy, under your leadership. It's gotten better and better. And this take action piece, as is true of, I think, our partnerships and working groups and task forces and so on, a unique and absolutely indispensable part of our efforts to protect the country we love, as I said at the outset. Tommy Waller, thank you again for all you do. Come back to us with updates on this. I pray that we will get through this GMD tonight in not too bad an order. God bless you, my friend. We'll talk with you soon. We'll be right back with more right after this. Stay tuned, folks.
After night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. We're joined by Robert Charles, a former Assistant Secretary of State, among many other roles he's had in all three branches of the U.S. government, clerk in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, worked in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses, also served, as I said, as the man at the State Department in charge of narcotics and international legal affairs. He is a go-to guy for us, especially in his role as the spokesman for a marvelous organization of which I'm proud to be a member, the Association for Mature American Citizens, or AMAC. You can follow him at amac.us. Bobby, it's good to have you back, sir. Welcome.
Frank, it's always good to be with you. And, you know, securing America is probably the topic of the day everywhere.
Well, it should be, that's for sure. Let me start by talking to you about a piece that you published at AMAC, I think on the 7th of May, in which you spoke about new Americans. You called it baloney. This seems to be just the latest iteration of an ever-evolving effort by the left to obscure what is being done with what used to be called illegal immigration, involving illegal aliens, and is morphed into, migration and now new Americans. It's just mind-boggling, but there are two facets of what's happening that is so much more important than just what is being used to, kind of confuse or delude the American people. Namely, the security elements of all of this, and then we'll talk next about some political warfare implications. But you've been involved in the law enforcement side of the State Department and international diplomacy. How would you characterize the security risks associated with what is, in fact, an open border these days?
Yeah, well, it's a geopolitical issue. It's an issue right here close to home at our elbow. And one of my iterations, Frank, was 10 years as an intelligence officer, and information warfare is a system that they use, that we use, but they use, we use it to try to bring the truth to the world, and they use it to try to obscure the truth. I think if George Orwell were alive today, he would either be mortified or highly impressed that everything that he predicted is happening, and worse. And so the big first issue I'll unpack for you is that security implication tied to the abuse or use or redefinition of language. It is in this particular area happening. We were first told we couldn't use the words illegal alien. Although in defending one of them, Biden recently called him an illegal. But at the end of the day, we were first told we can't use certain words, and then these words were slowly redefined. They were an undocumented, blah blah blah, and down. And now we're to that point in the scale that comes just before making an illegal alien a founding father. They're now a new American, and the implications of this in this particular case are social as well as I think security. If you open the door and say that anybody who comes to our border and knocks on the door, or doesn't even bother to knock, just comes straight in, is somehow a new American. You know, you know your family lives in your house, but all they have to do is walk through your front door and they're now part of your family. Then you've completely redefined the definition of family, or in this case, citizen. Or in this case, American. And what the governor of Maine has done with a Democrat legislature is they have created an office they call the Office of New Americans. Well, why would you do that? They do that because they have a bunch of illegal aliens that they invited into the state that they've given free housing to. Mainers don't get two years of free housing. They not only get 2 years of free housing in places like Brunswick, Maine, but the housing is luxury housing, Frank. They've got gorgeous, beautiful things in there. And that housing was probably going to be utilized by veterans. So you know, it's a three-way loss. You've redefined the definition of what a citizen is for the state of Maine or for America. You've given away things that taxpayers don't have the money for anyway. And you have taken them away from the people who might deservingly have paid money for them or been entitled to them. So a real loss. Then I looked at this a little closer and I realized that it's not just Maine. There are 18 states in which a network of so-called New Americans offices are being promoted by mysterious sort of dark money people tied to the Democrat Party. And you say to yourself, so what's really going on here? And I think that really takes you to the political side. But the side that's so disheartening is our leaders are knowingly, they check their integrity at the door, Frank. At the state and local and federal level, Democrats have drunk the Kool-Aid and decided that they are permitted to lie to us openly, try to affect our thinking because we don't care. You know, no kidding, there was a poll that came out in the last 2 weeks from Pew, of all people, but a Pew Research Center that said that more than 80% of Americans, more than 80% of Americans of all parties, all races, all sexes, both sexes, say that they believe that the people who are in charge in their state or federal government don't care what they think. Well, that is a crisis of profound confidence in the democratic process. And if you really want to know who's the danger to democracy, it's the guy that's pushing that. And that's Joe Biden and his lefty crowd.
Big time. This brings me to the political piece of all of this, Bobby. I think where you were going with your narrative about new Americans is that new Americans in many of those states, if not all 18, and perhaps others to be determined, are going to be given the right that is exclusively reserved for American citizens, namely the right to vote. Talk a bit about what that's shaping up to be and what it might mean in a state like yours in Maine, for example.
Well, and I appreciate that opening. You know, Frank, I was an investigator for 5 years. I try very hard to reach conclusions reluctantly. I'm not a conspiracy guy. I want to find all the pieces of the puzzle and put it together before I tell you what the picture on the puzzle actually is. What I have now discerned is that there is a method to the madness in the same way that in some prior investigations we did, we found corruption. there is method to what they're doing. And what they're doing is they house these people. Maine is a good example. They house these people under a quote unquote New Americans office. They house them and they send them a piece of literature, like a letter from the governor saying, congratulations and welcome to the state of Maine. Okay. They then give them free benefits, which have, again, of course, come by the United States Postal Service, carefully directed to these illegal aliens that are now new Americans in this housing that ought to have been paid for but is now free. They then take that envelope in a state that does not have voter ID, like Maine, and they can go with either an absentee ballot, which requires nothing but a request and can be filled out by someone else with them. I mean, legally cannot be, but easily can be. Or they can take that piece of paper with the instructions from the folks that tell them what to do. Some of them can't even speak English. And they can go straight to the voter booth, to a town office, because they have early voting in Maine, as they do in a lot of these other states. And they can vote. And yes, they have to say they're a citizen, but they haven't got a clue what they're saying, a lot of them. They're just here to get as many freebies as possible. Assimilation is not even, you know, they aren't where they were, which is what the goal of where they are is. And if they're told by someone, hey, you need to vote for the Democrats. So what you get is a loop. You get a loop where more illegal aliens, and apparently in Maine, the Democrats want to bring 75,000 illegal aliens into the state. I'm sure it's true in all these other places. I was just reading that Montana mysteriously got busloads of illegal aliens that it got off in somewhere like Kalispell, and they have no clue what to do with them. They don't even know where they are. And so what happens? They're carefully organized, orchestrated, corralled into housing, given that document that tells them it's just a piece of mail, that they live there. Now they have residence in the state. Now they go, they vote. And what happens? The Democrats that only, if we flip 8 seats in this state, then the Democrats are gone. Well, if you have 75,000 new voters who are voting for you, well, you're going to still be there. So it's a perpetuation of power by illegality and, frankly, by a utter lack of integrity and respect for the constituent, the voter, the average person, Frank.
Well, the law, not least.
The law as well. And, I mean, not to mention the law.
Yeah. And Bobby, you know, it's important to say this, I think, directly. There have been those, many of them probably bear a certain resemblance to the people who've been mutating the language, who have insistently told us that it is a conspiracy theory to suggest that what they're trying to do is replace American voters with these foreign nationals who would otherwise not be entitled to cast ballots in our country. And by the way, I just think it's so important to say, everyone who does cast a ballot in that setting is essentially canceling out the vote of an actual American.
Yeah, you know, Frank, it's just like physics or chemistry. You pour a different solution into the water, you dilute what was there. And what we're seeing is a dilution of the citizenship rights that we all think we have.
But I just want to make this point, Bobby. You're not a conspiracy theorist.
I'm not
a conspiracy theorist. I'm called that all the time, but that's not the case. What you're describing is a fact-based analysis of what is being done to our country with malice aforethought, you've concluded, by the people who are running things like our borders. And one of them was just impeached by the House of Representatives and didn't even get a trial in the Senate because the partisan political machinations there.
It's Orwellian, Frank, and it's Orwellian, and a good attorney general at the federal level or at the state level would not be allowing this to happen. It's an abdication of responsibility by those in whom we have vested trust, and more, it's a betrayal because they are truly trying to change the constitutional process illegally.
Bobby Charles, a perfect point at which to end. We will be coming back to you on this topic, I know, and more, because everything hangs in the balance in this coming election on that subject. God bless you, my friend. Keep up the great work at amac.us. The Honorable Robert Charles, we look forward to our next visit with you. We'll be right back with the rest of you on the other side of this short break. Stay tuned, please.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Biden administration's outrageous efforts to surrender our nation's sovereignty and personal medical freedoms to a Chinese Communist Party asset running the World Health Organization turns out to have another problem. It would also supplant U.S. states' rights to make decisions on public health, a power the federal government is not assigned under the Constitution and therefore is not entitled to give away to Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus or anybody else. This position was powerfully declared yesterday by 22 states' attorney general in the second formal throwdown with President Biden over the WHO in as many weeks. Like every Republican member of the Senate, these states' senior legal officers reject the accord still being stealthily negotiated less than 3 weeks before they are supposed to be approved. That approval must not happen. Join these American patriots in saying so at sovereigntycoalition.org. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we are joined by one of our favorite guests. His name is Robert Spencer. He is one of our colleagues at the Center for Security Policy, a senior fellow there. You can follow him at centerforsecuritypolicy.org. He is also, among other things, the executive director of a marvelous online resource, jihadwatch.org, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. He's a columnist for Front Page Magazine and PJ Media. He is the author of 28, count them folks, 28 books, including the book that is now available for pre-order, anxiously awaited, Muhammad, A Critical Biography. Robert Spencer, welcome back to Securing America. It's great to have you with us, sir.
Always good to see you, Frank. Thank you.
I'm particularly anxious to talk with you about a topic that is top of my mind, Robert. I imagine on yours too, especially since you've just written on the subject. I know it is. And that is the aligning by the Biden administration of the United States government with a terrorist organization that has wrought immense harm on an ally of this country, Israel, and seeks our destruction as well as that of Israel, and that would be Hamas. President Biden is apparently all in on this project. President Trump has taken him to task for it, accusing him of siding with the terrorists. My feeling is that Biden is way beyond sort of siding with the underdog, as I imagine he sees it here. It seems he's actually seeking its victory over our ally, Israel. Would you agree?
Oh, I would agree 100%, Frank. Look, Rafah is the last stronghold of Hamas. That's the last place where there are organized units of Hamas forces. If Israel destroys them, then Hamas is essentially a history, matter of history in terms of being an active force arrayed against Israel. Now, this is where the Biden administration has drawn the line and said, you must not go into Rafah. So that essentially is exactly equivalent to saying, you must not destroy Hamas. You must allow Hamas to live. And meanwhile, of course, let's remember that he gave a sanctions waiver to Iran, allowing it access to $10 billion. And Iran is funding Hamas. And so not only is Joe Biden, on the one hand, trying to stop Israel from destroying Hamas, on the other hand, he's essentially funding Hamas.
Yes. And more to the point, I think he's providing all manner of other aid and comfort to that enemy. I'm thinking in particular of something I've been just crazed by from its announcement in the State of the Union address, namely that the United States was going to build a port. Well, let's be clear, for Hamas off the coast of Gaza. What is the purpose of that port, Robert? How is this likely to play out as you see it?
Ostensibly, the port is to provide humanitarian aid to Gazan civilians who are supposedly threatened with famine because of the Israeli incursion into Gaza. Now, the reality is that if you look, for example, at the aid trucks, there are 150 aid trucks that go in on average, I believe it's every week, into Gaza. and 130 of them are immediately commandeered by Hamas, and 20 are left for the people and the humanitarian aid that is supposedly needed. And so what would be different about this port? Exactly nothing. This would be reinforcing and supplying Hamas. Now, people say, well, it's just humanitarian aid. There's all manner of things that can be done with humanitarian aid. For example, if you give cement, as this is what we've seen in Gaza, you get cement to for the infrastructure to build buildings, to rebuild all the buildings that have been destroyed, and they'll build tunnels to smuggle weapons and get into Israel to kill more civilians. They did it before, they will do it again.
You bet they will, if they survive. And Robert, at the same time that all of that is taking place, the Biden administration seems to be actively seeking to take down the government of Israel in a number of ways, having elections that would topple Benjamin Netanyahu, having the International Criminal Court prosecute him, having his reputation sullied in every way, and promoting those within the Israeli cabinet to help engineer not only his removal from power, but also a two-state solution, as they call it. What's wrong with that picture, sir?
Well, this is obviously part of the international left and its efforts to essentially create socialist governments all over the world. And the Biden administration hates Netanyahu because Netanyahu wants a strong and secure Israel. And Israel is an enemy of the left for a variety of reasons. One of them being that the left essentially wants to destroy nation states and create this international socialist supranational conglomerate. And Israel being a very particular kind of state with its centering on a particular ethnicity and religion, this is unacceptable to the leveling and collectivism of the left. So Biden wants to destroy Israel. Netanyahu's standing in his way. That's really the bottom line.
You didn't use the word anti-Semitism in that description of the left, but I think there's a fair amount of that operating as well, is there not?
No doubt about it, absolutely. And here again, it's the same thing. The left is collectivist. It wants equity, which means absolute uniformity and the obliteration of distinctions between human beings. And that means you can't have a Jewish state. It has to go. Islamic states are okay because they inculcate obedience to the ruler. That's why so many of them are authoritarian dictatorships. And they are internationalist also in orientation.
Internationalist being a euphemism for anti-Western civilization, anti-US in particular, but most especially anti-Israel. And Robert, I guess what you've just described is an act of betrayal on the part of this administration. Betrayal, most obviously, of an ally, namely the Jewish state of Israel, but also betrayal of the overwhelming sentiment of the American people and the vital interests of this country, specifically to defeat people who seek its destruction, not lift them up, not give them states, not empower them with riches and weapons and so on. We'll come back to how bizarre this is and how dangerous on the other side of this very short break. Robert Spencer will stay with us. I hope you will too. Welcome back. We're visiting I'm very pleased to say, with Robert Spencer, our friend, our colleague at the Center for Security Policy, where he is a senior fellow, as well as our muse on many things having to do with the threat we face from what I call Sharia supremacism. Robert, we were talking about this, well, betrayal by the Biden administration of Israel, and I would argue the 80% of the American people who, according to the latest Harvard-Harris poll, support Israel, not Hamas. And more to the point, our vital strategic interests. Our colleague and friend Sam Faddis has written a piece at andmagazine.com at Substack. And it's about a man that you and I have talked about a little bit in the past, Mehar Bitar, both a problem, I think, in his own right, but also an exemplar of what has happened as a result of a deal struck between Biden and assorted Muslim Brotherhood entities doing business as M-Gage in the run-up to the 2020 election. Tell us a little bit about this example of the old adage, people are policy. What do we know about Bitar? What do we know about what he's doing? How is it contributing to this, well, this betrayal, as I say?
Well, as you noted, Frank, this is the result of a promise that Biden has actually kept to M-Gage, a Muslim Brotherhood-linked organization trying to increase the presence of Muslims in government and in elected offices. And he told them in 2020 that he would appoint Muslims to every level of his administration. The unspoken corollary was that he would appoint Muslims who were acceptable to the Muslim Brotherhood apparatus in the United States. Mehar Bitar is one of them. And so people are policy in this case, because Bitar and others, such as Hadi Amer, Arian Tabatabai, many others in the administration, clearly have a bias toward the Palestinians, a soft spot for the Palestinian jihad against Israel, a deep contempt and hatred for Israel, a very favorable view of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and look at the policies of the Biden administration. They are 100% in line with that.
Yeah. Mehar Bitar, just for calibration purposes, is now the guy in charge of intelligence for the National Security Council of the United States. And as Sam points out in his article, that's a role that is not only the arbiter of what kind of intelligence gets to the president, but also what kind of direction is given to the intelligence community. It's fraught, to say the least, when you have somebody who is, as he is, a guy going back to his college days, is very active in the Students for Justice in Palestine program. We're seeing a lot of it on college campuses these days, a radical, I call it red-green axis operation, Robert, the communists as well as the Islamists. And also, I gather he was for a time employed by UNRWA. Remind us what UNRWA is and how it plays into this whole saga.
Incredible, Frank. This is the United Nations Relief Agency for Palestine. It's noteworthy that the UN has one relief agency for refugees all over the entire world, and then a second and separate relief agency specifically and solely for the Palestinians.
How is that, Robert? I've never quite understood how that
works.
Well,
you know, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation is 57 Muslim governments, and I believe that they are the largest voting bloc in the United Nations ever since the collapse of the Soviet bloc. And consequently, they're able to essentially do whatever they want. They've been able to get the UN Human Rights Commission to have a standing agenda item agenda number 7. Every time they convene, they have to talk about alleged human rights violations of Israel. There's no other country gets this kind of treatment. And
indeed, many of the countries that deserve that kind of treatment are on the dang.
Exactly.
Thing, right?
So the UN, the UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine, has been demonstrated recently to have been actively involved, its personnel actively involved, hundreds of them, in the October 7th massacre. And meanwhile, in UNRWA schools, you have the jihad against Israel being taught as a virtue, hatred of Israel being taught as a virtue. And this is under United Nations auspices.
Right. In other words, there are abundant enemies of Israel that are operating here. It's not just the Biden administration. It's not just the obvious players, Iran and its proxies. It is the United Nations. It is various organizations. In fact, as I recall, the Director General of the World Health Organization, who we are now some 17 days away from making the arbiter of global health policy everywhere, has determined that Gaza is a public health emergency of international concern. And under his new powers, he will have the authority to tell us what to do about that, which can only add another layer, I imagine, of subversion of Israel and pressure, you know, on her to surrender to these jihadis. Robert, just a quick word. We've got about a minute and a half left. I'm asking everybody I can get my hands on. How do you think allies elsewhere around the world, allies of the United States, that is, are perceiving what's taking place here, and for that matter, our enemies as well?
Well, they're seeing that the Biden administration is worried about the November election, and specifically worried about the threats that Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib and Nihad Awad of the Hamas-linked Council on American Islamic Relations have issued, telling Biden that if he doesn't toe the line and betray Israel, then that he will get no Muslim Arab votes, not a single one, in November. And that could make the difference. That could be the tipping point for Michigan and other swing states. And so Biden's taking this very seriously, and he is accordingly betraying Israel. This is a signal to our allies that their alliances with the United States are completely dependent upon domestic politics inside the U.S., and that a lasting and longstanding alliance cannot be counted on if there's a change of administration. So this essentially means that every ally in the world that the United States has cannot count on us. It sees proof of that. And many of them, we have to be realistic, are already making arrangements for a post-American future.
Yeah, a separate peace with our enemies, who are, of course, being emboldened by all of this as well. Robert, this is a point to which we'll return. I have a theory that there's a lot more going on than just domestic politics, an ideological enmity towards Israel as well, as we've been discussing. We'll sort this out in the days to come. Thanks for joining us. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.